get started promptly on the next program. And you heard me earlier talk about how, as an industry, we're averaging, some will say, 76% of drug produced for a study is wasted. This panel will tell you how to get down to zero.
Zero. Good morning. How many of you had a late night last night? I don't see Devendra in the room, but I have a suggestion for next year. I think we need an American Idol competition. So I'm working on getting Simon Cowell and Terry Crews on board. So today's topic is around waste and clinical supply chain. It's a very important topic for us. We heard in the first panel the importance of budgeting, and especially for small startups, you know, there are other budgetary constraints. And so, you know, controlling waste is really going to free up money for other studies. And so it's really a key topic. My name is Alan Jock. I'm with Kinaxis. We can help you with end-to-end planning. And I'm going to let the panel each introduce themselves quickly. And Deborah, you can do it again.
I can do it.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Dawn Wright. I am the head of Global Clinical Supplies at Insight in Wilmington, Delaware. I have a lot of years of experience. I don't want to tell you how many. But I've been at Insight for about 4 years now. Prior to that, I was at PPD for a few years, learning the CRO side of the business. And then before that, I spent the majority of my career at GlaxoSmithKline. And I have to admit that this morning, those extra drink tickets don't seem like such a good idea. Just saying.
I love it. Well, if you're here for the last panel, I already gave away how many years I've been doing this, but just to put that in perspective, I started in clinical trials before there was a such thing as an IRT. Mm-hmm. So talk about a disruptor. We used to package, the patient number was the med ID number, and so you had to package for every patient. That was a lot of waste. So there are ways to bring technology in, and that was one of them that made a big difference, and then we'll talk about some of the ones coming up.
Excellent. Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Jan-Pieter Capelle, JP. I'm VP of Clinical Services at Inceptua. Inceptua is a leading global sourcing, comparative sourcing company. And I'm having responsibility for all the things related to warehousing, packaging, labeling, distribution, reverse logistics. My prior experience is from an IRT company where I had the honor to develop and commercialize a demand modeling and a supply planning tool. So we can talk about that, how that can help out on waste management. And then 15 years prior to that, I was heading up clinical supply chain functions with UCB and Amgen.
Great, and I am Kat Hall. I am the head of GXP quality assurance at a company called Ignite, which is a content management and collaboration portal. I have been in the industry like all of my fellow colleagues for a couple decades. Before I got into software development and quality assurance, I was in clinical supply chain for a couple decades at a variety of different big and size big to small pharmaceutical companies, and I'm also on the ISPE Investigational Product Steering Committee as well as BSMA Steering Committee.
Thank you. So that one number really struck me when I first saw it, 76%, that's the McKinsey-POBO study. How many of you think you're in that range? Because when I first heard that just sounded crazy. Is that what you're experiencing in your clinical work? Any hands? 76 resumes?
Got some hands, yeah. Over here.
and I'd like to put the same question to the panel. In your experience, Dawn, we were talking about where you were when you started, where you are now. That was interesting.
But
is that what you all have experienced?
So I would say when I first started out my career, we really just packaged for a study. Like we figured out how much drug we needed for the study, and they manufactured, packaged it. If it just so happened that there were two studies starting at the same time, they may have combined them. So that's how it started. We had, I'm sure we had a ton of overage, a ton of waste. So then fast forward to now, at Insight, we actually have a system. We have over 100 clinical trials in that system. So we've come a long way. We'll talk more about our system a little bit later.
Where would you say you are now?
So I would say with waste that we are at a place where we're a lot better than we were. But I think we still have a lot more room to improve.
So you're at 75.
I love that question because we often get the question, well, what should our overage be, right? And overage versus waste, and we'll talk about that, I think, in a little bit. But there is no one right answer. It's not like, oh, build your Excel sheet, put in 15%, and you'll be good. Because if it's a tiny study in many sites, you need to make sure that there's product at that site. And if that site never enrolls a patient, that's lost material, right? So it depends. If you have many sites and a large study, it's a lot easier to have a lower percentage. So the percentage is a bit misleading. I don't believe 76%.
I think based on what I see with our clients, it's not unrealistic. You know, I see those numbers, but again, there's a lot of factors for that. But the number in itself is not also very meaningful to me. And the reason why is I was part of a TÜV initiative maybe about 7 years ago, also to look into what overage and waste basically was in the industry. And I think the very first 4 or 5 meetings we had, we kept debating what is included. What should you factor into your number? And very often, what we found out is some companies do neglect what is sent to the sites. You know, if it's not being used, I don't know, it's not in my system anymore. So I don't see that as a component of waste. And another element is where do you start? You know, is it just talking about your drug product, the finished drug product? Or, what about the drug product and the drug substance that you initially built, with the intention to use, and it's not going to be used. So the number can be much bigger than the 76% if you factor in all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think probably the reason that quality came and stuck to my back is because I was the queen of saying, well, the answer is it depends, to what Dev's point is. Because certainly back in the day when we were labeling patient numbers, visit numbers on all the drug, if that site didn't enroll those patients, then technically that was all waste. But you didn't have a choice. You had to send an entire block of drug back in those days. Mm-hmm. And then we got IRT and it expanded us into the globe. And then it became, well, now I got to go put drug all over across the world, and I don't really know if those patients are going to go to that country and enroll in that study within my expiry period. So I think if I can lead us into the next question, it comes down to what do you define as waste?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be a purist, and I'm going to define waste as anything that doesn't get used. And I'm not saying that there are not good reasons for that. It's not planned, but that'll be my starting point, so I'll play devil's advocate.
And I love to take the argument. For those of you who were here last year, I'm a healthy debater. And certainly across my career, the previous panel talked a lot about, communication, talking with partners, having that transparency of, well, what are we being prepared for? What is our objective? What is our goal? And certainly across my career, waste was a matter of risk mitigation. So how much value do you put on putting a little bit extra drug into the forecast, into that country, into that site, in order to mitigate the risk that you're going to lose a patient in a very critical trial that is trying to go faster, that is trying to get to market to deliver on patient success, which I know all of your companies have somewhere in their mission or their vision, right, is that we're going to try to make patients healthier in this world. And so, you know, a lot of that comes down to the conversation. But on the antithesis, I have certainly seen many supply chain managers, including myself, make some strategic errors in their planning. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, sometimes if you had a crystal ball to look back in time and say, well, I would have told you don't do that because this is going to change and this is going to change and this is going to change and that's going to end up throwing a lot of drug away. So sometimes you can think about that up front of like, what potential shifts in this study am I going to be prepared for?
I think it was from a panel yesterday, Allison, I think it was from Sunoco, talked about when you talk about waste, there's people, planet, and profit. And I want to give you credit for that.
I loved that.
Because,
as well,
you know, we work with, again, some of those small companies that are trying to ration every last tablet, and they end up quadrupling the number of shipments to the sites. Mm-hmm. And so did you save in doing that? You ended up spending more money, and your carbon footprint is huge as a result. And so it's that balance of optimization. So, you know, yes, that tablet might have been wasted, but you ended up saving shipment costs as a result.
Yeah. So maybe to add a little bit on that, because you know, I totally agree with what you say, but there's a kind of a snowball effect if you just keep on adding and adding.
Absolutely.
And again, that goes to the end-to-end supply chain. At some point in time, you're triggering your next drug product batch that is needed, really, to fit all that demand that you're building up for, and then the next API comes in, which is coming in at a much higher cost. So I think you have to, and we spoke about that in different panels already, really consider the end-to-end kind of implications of what you do. So you're utilizing resources that can be utilized differently, you know, at the same cost for different products, for different studies, and, you know, also impacting the planet. Like, you know, we don't want to build for waste, you know, so if we can just bring in that element of the, you know, carbon footprint as well, that is very meaningful of, you know, realizing the offset of the risk versus like implications.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Agree with you.
So just a quick comment. In my experience, which is totally on the commercial side, as many decades as you guys have been on the commercial side, but in my experience, every part of the supply chain wanted a buffer, right? No one ever wanted not to be able to ship, you know, when they were supposed to ship. And the issue was that, you know, we had buffer on buffer on buffer, just like you said, Jamie. Yeah. And when you gave somebody responsibility for managing the entire supply chain, they would have that visibility. They'd be able to see how much buffer there was across the supply chain.
Yeah.
And I suspect in the clinical world that could be the same, that if someone took a holistic view, they would realize, you know, everybody has overage, and maybe, you know, when you add it all up, that's
right,
way more than we need. But another question, this comes from the first panel, because I really like that panel. When you're deciding on overage and buffering and things like that, are you taking into account the flexibility of your API or drug substance manufacturer, your drug product manufacturer, your packaging site? Because obviously, if you can only get a batch every year, you're going to have a different approach than if you could get maybe two batches a year or three batches a year in capacity availability. So could you talk a little bit about how you've seen that play into your decisions?
Don, you want to start?
I can speak on at least my experience with Amgen. So there, to your first question, was more kind of a mindset that we need to understand the end-to-end buffers in the network. So how much do we hold at API, how much do we hold at DP, how much do we hold at finished product, and then, you know, downstream to the sites. And when we started collecting that data, it was just shocking, just to see if you added up how much it is. If you turn that, you know, commercially into number of days of inventory, you know, it's years, it's not months,
yes.
It's scary. But that's a good starting point, really, to have discussions like, you know, as a company, what would be your strategy? Where do you think you need to hold your strategic inventory, and for what reasons? You don't need to have to hold that at each and every level, but you need to be open on the choices that you make so that there's an understanding if something happens in the supply chain, there's a need for a faster response if there's less of a buffer in there. Mm-hmm. So there's you know, different kind of approaches you can take, but take a look at your entire supply chain to understand where you really want to hold your inventory.
And how long it takes you to get from to medication at patient.
Right.
I think the stability of the product at each of those stages matter, as well as the temperature conditions, because when you think about, you know, calculating your waste and shipping material to the clinical sites, you can do all kinds of really cool things with controlling those shipments, and then it's in the site's hands. And that's where you'll find temperature excursions make some of your product get wasted as well. So all that needs to get into the calculus.
I was going to say, also, I have an example early on in my career when we were adding buffers all along the process, like you mentioned. We had a situation where we were at a turning point. We were out of space in our warehouses. So the question was, do we get a new warehouse and store more of it, more API, more drug product that hasn't been used, or do we get on board and make some changes? And that's when some supply chain people were brought in. There were some resistors. I'm not going to say who that was. But eventually, we all got on board and started to fall in with the principles. And we started using Excel, aggregating the data across all the studies, across the portfolio, working back through drug product and API. And so that was a big improvement.
Yeah, I would just add to it, like, you know, we're talking about buffers, but you also have to look at the offset of where in your end-to-end supply chain do you have what I famously called the window of opportunity? Where do you have that critical decision point that if you don't tell API I need another batch, or I don't tell product that I need another manufacturing slot, right? Where do you have the opportunity to see what the enrollment really is? Because the one thing that we all know within supply chain planning is that's going to be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So where am I going to see what it's actually doing, where it's actually performing, where the investigators are performing or they're done? And where can I go to ClinOps and say, you know what, my expiry is coming up. These 10 sites are doing nothing. If I resupply them, it's going to cost me this. And if they don't enroll, right, that's all waste. Do we have that opportunity to relook at, okay, let's shut them down, find a new site, find a new opportunity? And I think that's an important thing when you're looking at your overall buffers. If you're just going to blanket and say, I'm going to be prepared for, you know, I think the statistic is still 11% of your sites are not going to enroll, and you're generally just going to keep that there as your buffer, or you're going to have that opportunity to go to ClinOps and say, and for the next expiry batch, they're done. Mm. And those are tough conversations.
Yeah.
So, tagging on to that, Kat, how common is it to see what we would call an S&OP process in clinical? In other words, Bill's talking about all the different functions and the silos and the lack of communication. How common have you seen S&OP processes where everybody sits down and looks at all of that, exactly what you're talking about, from API to patient enrollment, and assesses a plan, I'd say at least on a monthly basis, and possibly even includes contract manufacturers at the table?
I think I've been fortunate in my career of where I've been that I have seen it. I've seen it in a variety of different formats. It can be informal, it can be very formal. I've seen it where, I know in the last panel, the question was, do you have a procedure for that, right? And I have been in parts of organizations where, yes, there was not only a procedure, but as a supply chain project manager, I wasn't allowed to start until I got ClinOps signature on that request form, right? It was not a real study until they signed that. And they were often reluctant to put their name on the paper and say, yeah, I can tell you that this is real. And you'd be sitting there like, but I need something. I'm now gonna be the rate limiter, right? And you're putting pressure on me. So, I mean, there's good and bad to all of that. The more that you structure it, then you find out how much one trial is not like the other, one situation is not like the other. You're always gonna be asking for exceptions, right? But I think if you are going to be successful in clinical supplies, you have to have those conversations. You know, whether or not it's everybody around one table, or at least you're going out to ClinOps and having the conversation there, and the clinical development team there, and the CMC team there, and just being that bridge of visibility and conversation between all the parties so that you can at least, you know, help provide everyone that visibility.
We'll work with, obviously, you know, large and small clients, and I think it's surprising even, you know, some of the large ones, the process isn't as robust as you might think, and we're actually helping them to build it out a little bit more. It's like, if you can give us more than 2 months notice, we can help you. help us help you. But what's interesting is where I think I'm also seeing an evolution in the small clients to where there's a lot more supply chain intelligence coming in. You know, often we'll talk about a client being sort of three men in a molecule. Mm-hmm. You got the CFO, the CEO, and, you know, and the clinops, but we're starting to see a lot more intel, probably, you know, thanks to an organization like this, come into where people are starting to ask those questions, and it's making a big difference.
I think in my career I was fortunate to have worked companies that have kind of similar processes, like we call it DNOP, Development Operations Planning. And it's adding so much more just on creating a shared understanding of what is happening. We all know, you know, change is constant in what we do in, you know, the last part of the supply chain. But if we don't communicate that effectively upstream, in terms that people can understand that the variability of their planning is going to be impacted by what's happening with the studies, you know, then they are just planning for something that's not needed. And I also learned in that setting that there's different kind of objectives that the different parties are having around the table, which I was never ever realizing. But, you know, our production department had the objective to be most effective, most efficient. You know, they want to use every minute of production capacity to, you know, get paid for, so to say. And they were building inventory for me. It didn't need it. You know, it's what built for scrap, guaranteed. And so just having that discussion, which really, you know, requires a leadership team to be open-minded and wanting to, you know, set other priorities. So that's the power of being together, explaining it, understanding how the business is run, and what the implications for everybody are.
Absorption has been my biggest enemy most of my career. I've seen that so many times.
Yeah.
What I'd like to do now is take a little break and see if there are any questions in the audience.
Not that one.
No, I told you you couldn't ask any questions.
Remember, you're next.
And I like the discussion and also some of the points that JP mentioned, expanding waste in the carbon footprint, and Ted, you mentioned bringing everybody to the table. But just asking a question, do you know how many shipments go to one clinical site for one clinical trial that you're supporting? Any idea?
Well, I know, you know, enough examples what's planned for. And then in reality, it can be a multiple of what's being planned for. You know, if you would plan for monthly kind of shipments, maybe as a starting point, there's very often two or three shipments that can go out every week for.
So let's expand the question a little bit. We're talking about drug supplies. How about lab kits, ancillary supplies, medical equipment, spare parts, documents?
Yeah.
I think when we were at Martin, together we did an analysis of like easily 20 shipments from different providers and sometimes arriving on the same day.
Yeah.
So I think there's some room to talk about waste and how to reduce the carbon footprint as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think when I was in IRT for a few years, it was one of my objectives of like, why, you know, we have IRT systems that automate the distribution of clinical supplies, and yet kits and the lab side of it is all on spreadsheets and being manually handled. And, you know, whenever I went out and talked to sites about, you know, how could sponsors make your life easier? And they're like, could you make sure every box clearly identifies what protocol this is for? I get a box of syringes. And I don't know who it's from, and I don't know which study it's for. So they just go into a general supply, and then later on, you know, there's an uptick in your trial, and they're like, well, we don't have any syringes. And they're like, what do you mean? We sent you like 20,000 for the entire trial. And they're like, oh, that was just for yours? Ooh. Right? So I do think that there's a lot of opportunity to coordinate that within the industry. But I think you run into that silo mentality, right? That's managed over here by this team or the CRO. And it's hard to coordinate that.
Yeah, bringing the pieces together is so critical. And the IRT design, I mean, it certainly was a disruptor and a game changer, but now we have to use it to its power. You can use the IRT to control ancillaries. You can use the IRT to control other material. There's a lot of reluctance to do that, but because there's no med ID numbers and I can't track it that way. Well, it's not necessary. So, you know, and can you separate randomization from dosing? Is that possible in the protocol? If you can do that and you have a shipping window, then you can keep the drug back at the depot. You don't have to have it at the site. You can't always do that, but if you could, take advantage of the IRT to help you with those kinds of things. So the technology is there if we use it.
I would take it point further, if I may. I would take that point further.
Behind you, Devendra.
Where are you? Is she here? Would you kindly stand up? Could you answer this question?
How many shipments to a clinical site do you
expect? The question was,
in what trial?
Question was, I think what his incident, the hypothesis he has in his head, I can see it. There are too many shipments going to the same place that don't need to go in 10 different ways. They could go consolidated. There could be fewer shipments. Who would have the visibility of how many shipments are going to a depot or a destination in your organization?
Just for my scope of trial.
Yes, ma'am.
Me.
Yes, ma'am.
Me, I would have that.
You would have that.
Yeah.
For all the drug supplies? For all the drug supplies, also for all ancillary, lab kits, and return shipments?
I mean, if I'm managing the ancillaries, then I would. If they're being managed by the CROs and going directly to the sites, then I would have visibility to that. But if I'm managing the ancillaries,
so, Alan, with your permission, I just want to make a point for our entire industry. That is a huge opportunity. And who is going to address it? We're the one that is aware of the logistics of delivery, supplies, and drugs, and comparators, whatever they may be, to a particular destination. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I add to what he said? I immediately started thinking of IRT and how you set the controls within IRT to determine how often to ship. But I also occurred to me that sometimes that's dictated by how the study has been defined. And that can go as far as when should the first drug shipment be there? And oftentimes it ends up being told to be there and you don't even ever enroll a patient at that site. So does anybody have any success stories of how they have dealt with the language in the filing so that you can be more efficient in the amount of drug that needs to ship there?
Oh, now you're getting on my soapbox. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I have challenged in my past is how the treatment of drug supply is different in clinical trial monitoring than other things, right? So is the CRA going out there before they approve the site to make sure that those syringes are there and that they're stored appropriately? Are they going out there and making sure that the blood pressure machine is actually accurate and calibrated? Mm-hmm. The answer is no. So why then is it a requirement by ClinOps for a CRA to go physically on a site and verify that the drug supply is there? Because as a drug supply coordinator, you have all of that documentation and trail to prove that it's there, right? So, and you know, same, we can get into returns and reconciliation later in another panel, but you know, the same is on the reverse side, right? So drug is being treated differently, and it's not in the regulations that it has to be. It's just not.
I don't know. So, expectation. Yeah.
I was going to say, so for us, we have a lot of oncology studies. Typically, they require a biopsy that usually takes 2 to 3 weeks to get the results back. So we typically will ship our first supplies, drug supplies, at first patient screened at that site. Mm-hmm. So that does save us for all those sites that never recruit a single patient.
Yeah, and you can take that one step further, but that needs more an open-minded development team. But so you can even wait till the results are coming in, whether to see if there's eligibility to, you know, get entered in the study or not. So the patient needs to be scheduled anyway, so they're just waiting on the results. So the results are coming in. If the schedule is just a couple of days later, there's still time to ship. So you can even hold that. But yeah, there's this kind of idea that we will miss this opportunity to treat the patient if we don't have drug there. So your point that it's treated differently, absolutely agree. You know, if the other components that are needed are not there, the patients still do not get treated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. So it's your IRT systems, you really can help, but it's a discussion you need to have internally with your development operations team, with your study managers, to make sense out of this. And so an example from my experience, you know, some of those comparators are quite expensive. You know, when you add in that money, it becomes a different discussion, because if that money is not being used, then you know, that's going to be flagged. So it's trying to find the right, you know, arguments to see if you can make sense out of this.
Okay, I'd like to get through two more things, and then we'll have time at the end for some more questions.
Yeah. I got a question for JP. Yeah. JP, I don't want to embarrass you, but
everybody's going to embarrass you.
For the last 5-6 years, you've convinced me that the supply chain for clinical should be demand-driven.
Absolutely.
Yes or no?
Absolutely.
Everybody agrees, right? So if that's the case, why isn't the patient enrollment plan and data actual drive everything we're talking about?
Another soapbox.
Another soapbox.
I said this is another soapbox, but well, no. Ideally,
I'm just trying to get everyone aligned on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah, if we were just living in this world with, you know, very fast supply chains, then I would say you're getting closer to something like that. And there's good kind of examples, and I think we were going to talk about this in the next question. But you know, concepts of just-in-time labeling, late-stage postponement. So, not adding any more cost to anything that is potentially not going to be used is a good practice. So just hold it as central as possible, as long as possible, till you finally feel confident. You know, this product makes sense to be used. Let's ship it out. But yeah, demand-driven supply chains have been, you know, what I believe in, and I think we really need to move from inventory management to demand management.
Postponement also gives you the agility to ship that product somewhere else.
Correct.
Right. Not ship it where it's not needed. But yeah. I think Insight has done quite a bit on postponement.
Yeah. So we actually have combined drug pooling and just-in-time labeling. It's funny, we jumped in with both feet into this process about a year and a half ago. So five different projects, quite a few studies, and you know, it's really beneficial. So you know, we looked across like our portfolio and looked at our products. A lot of them were oral. We packaged them all in 35 count bottles. Like, why can't we do drug pulling? So we started to do it through, so we used Savota. They have a drug pulling option. We use that. We create one kit list across multiple studies. I think for one of our products, we may have 9 studies running, pulling from the pool. So it really, it has been very beneficial. So I would say though, so we do the just-in-time labeling. So it's very expensive. That's what we found. And we're trying to encourage other people to start using it so we can put more pressure on these vendors to give us better pricing. But we've been working through this, and where we've come is we finally realize that drug pulling and just-in-time should be used in certain cases. So it's really beneficial when you have a short shelf life, a product that is, we don't have a lot of supplies, right? So for whatever reason, we start up a study, we don't have a lot of supplies. If there are multiple studies, the good thing about it is if one study's recruiting and the other one isn't, all those supplies can go to the one that's recruiting. Mm-hmm. So it's really been beneficial, but what we've learned is we'll start out with this process and then switch to more of a standard packaging once we have more drug, a better shelf life, things like that.
Even without the just-in-time labeling, there's an opportunity to do aggregate demand planning. And it's mm-hmm. it works for the IMP, it works yeah. for the ancillary materials, yeah. and for the expensive comparator too. Yeah. Because you'll have multiple trials that are pulling on that same material. You keep it as far through the supply chain as you can, yeah. and you don't customize it to a site or to a study until the last minute. So you gotta be nimble, you gotta have stuff set up, labels right. printed, ready to go, everything ready to marry, and then it goes, and then you can start to do exactly that, where the busy study pulls inventory, you replenish it so that it's ready there for the yeah. slower study when they come along, but you don't have to have each study placing their own order requests and have it sit and expire.
Yeah. Yeah.